Jema. So we start chapter 15th of the Gita, basically. But here it is, the third chapter of the second series, part two of the second series. So that's from Essays on the Gita. But basically it is about the chapter 15 of the Gita. And the chapter is titled as Purushottama Yoga. So I'll say the page number, but we'll be reading a little after five. Page 435. So basically, what is the highest to which we can aspire for in terms of yoga? So we have been told there are several possibilities. One of them is, now here the chapter is three Purushas. So Pur is referring to a place. That's how we have in India many places which end with Pur. Madhupur, Bhagalpur. So Pur is a place. And Isha is the Lord. So basically, Purusha means the Lord of the place. So who is the Lord and where is his house? So there are the three houses or three places where the Lord dwells. We have been told this. One is Shara. Shara is that which is subject to change and mutation, which means this material world. So unlike this idea that all this is transient, therefore meaningless, the Gita does not say so. It says the divine dwells here also. That's one thing. Then the second is Akshara. But beyond this, there is the another place or another space or another state in which the divine dwells, and that is the Akshara. Akshara is from where there is no falling down, falling back. So Akshara, there is no degeneration, there is no deterioration, there is no change. So that's the another dwelling place. So most of the time we see these two spaces which are talked about, that there is this mutable world in which the change is taking place. And if we are in this mutable world, naturally we are subject to the law of change. Now, when we are subject to the law of change, we cannot find permanence. This is a common teaching. It stands to logic and common sense. But beyond this mutable world of becoming, constant becoming, there is the immutable Brahman. If we transit there, then we don't fall back. So that's what is called as mukti or moksha. If you enter into the immutable, then there is no falling back, because it is Akshara. It is not subject to the laws of change. So there are yogis who dwell here, but they are still subject to coming back into the cycle. And there are those who transit to the immutable. They are not subject to coming back into the cycle. This is the first thought. It is common to most spiritual teachings. The problem here is that from this it seems that the logical thing will be to go from the mutable to the immutable, because you don't want to, you know, experience all this transience, this change. But if you go to the immutable, you have already arrived at the higher truth, and so there is no need for action, there is no need for any further coming back into the world. But then we miss the meaning of the world. That's the other problem. So that's what we see in traditional spiritual literature, that the meaning of the world goes missing. Because then why did we come here if only to transit into some other place? So then comes the third Purusha, which Sri Krishna speaks of, which is something like a unique contribution of the Gita, which is not there in the Upanishads. It is there as a very seed thought somewhere in the Vedas, but it's not really developed, because there is the cosmic being and there is the beyond. But here there is the third status, third, the Lord, as the Purushottama. Uttama is the highest. So now there is the Purushottama, means the highest Purusha, who is beyond the mutable and the immutable. He holds the mutable and the immutable within himself. And that is the highest status, Paramdham, to which the soul can aspire. So what happens when we meet there? Now Purushottama is not just a poise or a state where there is imperturbable calm, there is no disturbance, all peace. But Purushottama has a divine personality. He has a divine power through which he operates in the world. He is the Lord. So therefore, the human personality finds its meaning there. So if we have to raise this question, what is the highest to which human love can go? What is the highest to which human knowledge can go? What is the highest that human beings can experience as joy? So we can point out the Purushottama. So otherwise, when we talk only of the immutable Brahman, it doesn't make sense, because all this has to be left behind. There is no scope of change here or transmutation. So that's why this is so crucial to action in the world, this ideal of the Purushottama. We can take a small example to understand, then we can proceed. So we can say that about any human being, there is a state in which we are just existing and we are not involved with anything. We are, say, in a state of calm, peace, sitting quietly. And then there is second state where we are involved in action. Now, are these the only two truths? If somebody says, you are Mr. Calm and Mr. Peace when I'm sitting, I would say no. I exist independent of this. So Purushottama is that which is exists independent. He is in both. He is in the mutable and the immutable, and he exceeds it. So we can take another example, that in the Shara or the mutable world, he is as the essence of things, like beauty of a rose. So where does beauty come from? It's changing, because it'll fade away. But yet it comes from the same truth. So there is in the mutable world the colors of dawn, the joy, or the, you know, various kinds of things that we experience in the world, they are all coming ultimately from the one source. And that source, here it is involved, therefore it is changing, it is mutable. The beauty of a rose fades away. But beauty as a self-existent truth doesn't fade away. It exists in the immutable. And it has its origin ultimately in the personality of the Purushottama. So this is the first main thought of this chapter. And the second is about the Ashwath tree. The Ashwath tree is when Shri Krishna explains the cosmic manifestation. So he gives the image of the Ashwath tree for our general thing. It's the sacred fig, the people tree. So it's worshipped in India, and all in most cultures is regarded as something sacred. So the Ashwath tree is this manifestation, but its roots are above in the divine and its branches are coming down. So I use this in scientific circles. I say it's a top-down view of creation rather than a bottom-up view. So right now in science we have a bottom-up view. We are trying to look at the divine from here. But actually it is the other way around. So you have to understand this, you must understand there. Because that's how creation has begun. Then it has got into the mud and slowly it is emerging. So that's, of course, Shobindo speaks of involution and evolution. So involution, if you really look at it, comes straight from the idea of the Ashwath tree. It is the tree with its roots above, and the tree grows downwards, its branches and all the leaves. So all the leaves are the hymns of the Vedas, a very beautiful description. And branches are getting into the mud through various attachment, desires. Everything ultimately is coming from there. But there are people who are only looking at the tree in this or that aspects. And they do not know the whole truth. Therefore, they are bewildered. They are going up and down the tree, trying to figure out. But they cannot know the end, either on this side or the other side. And this is what is the cycle of birth and rebirth in which human beings are there. But few yogis try to find the root, and they go beyond the manifestation to discover the root in the unmanifest. But then, as the Gita says, there is something beyond the manifest and the unmanifest, and that is the divine in which the tree itself is seated. So that's the basic thing about the Ashwath tree. It's a very important concept, and therefore he says, last thought is that those who are only busy counting the leaves and you know, it's, he uses a word that those who are only busy, he uses a word called Vedvad. So Vedvad is where there are people who are very busy, happy reciting all the slokas of the Vedas and the Upanishads and various kinds of ritual practices to get, you know, progeny and this and that. He says they are bewildered, they are still in ignorance. So the Gita speaks of going beyond the Vedvad. It says one who has found the divine has no more, for him the Vedas is like a man who is in the sea and he is holding a pitcher to fill water. So it'll be foolish. So Aurobindo says the same thing in one of his aphorisms, that all these scriptures are like a lamp we carry when we are moving through, navigating in darkness. But when we find the utter truth of God, then we have to discard this because the sunlight is there. So he speaks of going beyond the scriptures. So these are the main thoughts in this particular wonderful essay. So this is chapter 15. It's chapter 15 here, and it's also chapter 15 of the Gita. So the three Purushas. So we'll just, as always, read from some passages which are very beautiful, uplifting. We read the second paragraph. There is a spirit here at work in the world that is one in innumerable appearances. Very simple. That the beauty of a rose, the beauty of the butterfly, the beauty of the dawn, the beauty of a human being, beauty of an act, all these are ultimately beauty expressing itself in manifold ways. So it applies to everything. So there is one spirit which is assuming innumerable appearances. It is the developer of birth and action, the moving power of life, the inhabiting and associating consciousness in the myriad mutabilities of nature. So it is developing itself, better and better forms. So often we can, you know, this little exercise, at least once, I used to wonder, what is the highest expression of love? What it could be? So you see, it is trying to develop it. And then you end up with the divine sacrifice. You will end up with that, because there is nothing else which can be compared to that. So similarly, what is the highest expression of beauty? What could be the highest expression of joy or delight? And then slowly, slowly, it is developing itself in this creation through various forms. It is the constituting reality of all this stir in time and space. It is itself time and space and circumstance. So time, space and causality is ultimately this ultimate primal cause. It is this multitude of souls in the worlds. It is the gods and men and creatures and things and forces and qualities and quantities and powers and presences. So all this that we see here ultimately is due to that one presence which in myriad ways is manifesting itself. And then a few lines below, because we don't experience life like that. So Sri Aurobindo is aware of that. He says, but what we see obviously at work before us is not this eternal and this conscious Shakti, but a nature which in the blind stress of our operations is ignorant of the spirit within our action. So this is how we experience, and we use the word nature. But if you really look closely, there is a very beautiful book by Lyle Watson on supernature. If you just observe purely nature, you'll be amazed that there is evidently a consciousness and intelligence at work, which is only apparent in the works, but it's hidden. So you don't see the presence. Of course, if you, I'm not talking of a yogi, but in general. But you get that sense that this cannot be just random. There is something which is trying to express itself. So, yes, and her work is a confused, ignorant and limiting play of certain fundamental modes, qualities, principles of force in mechanical operation and the fixity or the flux of their consequences. And whatever soul comes to the surface in her action is itself in appearance ignorant, suffering, bound to the incomplete and unsatisfying play of this inferior nature. The inherent power in her is yet other than what it thus seems to be. For hidden in its truth, manifest in its appearances, it is the Shara, the universal soul. So we know nowadays, you know, when take a computer analogy, there is the hardware, the software, things which are appearing on the screen, and there is the skinware, the human being who is behind. In the human being, you can go further, that is the mind which is, you know, developing this entire. The mind is the unseen subtle thing. So an animal who just sees all this action, may get bewildered just by appearances. You know, he may see all the projections on the TV. The dog may feel it's a real dog coming out there. There are some nice videos of that. But even if it sees the human being, he still won't understand. There is something still deeper within the human being, which the human beings know as the mind, which is actually the one which is developing this action. So as an analogy, this. So first we have to discover it. We have to arrive at the hidden truth behind its manifest appearances. We have to discover the spirit behind these veils and to see all as the one Vasudevam Sarvamiti, individual, universal, transcendent. Of course, this all is the one we have talked about. It is not the way outwardly we try to see everything is one, everything is same. One is not equivalent to sameness. So oneness is not sameness. So those who can see the one will see beauty even in ugliness. But if he says that it's all the same, then that is sameness. You are forcibly trying to fit things. The world is a myriad forms of manifestation. There is diversity. There is the play of forces. But ultimately, all this derives from the one. And the typical example is the battlefield of Kurukshetra. The strength of Arjuna and the strength of Karna. The strength of Bhima and the strength of Duryodhana are the same one source of strength. But does it mean it doesn't matter then whatever, whichever side you take? No, it matters. Because the will of Krishna is now with the Pandavas. So that's where we have to understand. That's where the Purushottama comes in. So this is about the Shar. And then we can go to the Akshar, which is next paragraph. But then there is another spirit of whom we become aware and who is none of these things, but self and self only, an objectless delight, a formless beauty. You know, that a knowledge which is exists as wisdom within the heart of silence. So all these are the immutable. This spirit is eternal, always the same, never changed or affected by manifestation. The one, the stable, is self-existence, undivided, and not even seemingly divided by the division of things and powers in nature, inactive in her action, immobile in her motion. It is the self of all and yet unmoved, indifferent, intangible, as if all these things which depend upon it were not self. Not its own results and powers and consequences, but a drama of action developed before the eye of an unmoved participating spectator. It's like the sun. So the sun and the power of the sun, the energy of the sun, the light of the sun which comes to earth. As it comes, it gets modified. Some places are better lit, some are less lit. The moon, it shines because of the light of the sun. So all this is, but the sun itself remains unmoved. So we can experience these two statuses. One is where we are depending on the outer and seeing something which is beautiful or something which is touches something of the divine in the changing world. But then the problem is it's depending on the objects. And when the object fades and when the things change, that it's like a drama. So it changes, the scene changes. So we have this commonly in olden times in Hindi movies. You see, they used to show that two people are in love with each other. They never showed what happens after marriage. Because then it will become a happy movie will end up into a sad movie. So nobody likes to see sadness. That's why even news you will see. They feed things which are either very sensational or they are very extremely, they make you feel very happy. They make your adrenaline shot. So if one is living by the moment, one will say, oh, this is so wonderful. But hold on, just step back. These are all playing with possibilities. It's just to be moved. But there is a state in which one can remain in a state of calm, joy, peace, love, regardless. So obviously that's a liberation. If the love in my the love in my heart, the bliss in my heart, the peace in my heart does not depend on anything which is changing, that's obviously a higher state. So that's where the Akshara Brahma Paramam, that's how the Gita puts it. It is higher than the Shar. This is the Akshara, the immutable in the mutable, the immobile in the mobile, the imperishable in things perishable. That's how one of the Upanishads puts it, Kathopanishad, Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam Eko Bahu Nam Yavidhati Kama. Beautiful. He is the eternal in the transient. Nityo Nityanam Chetanas Chetananam. The one consciousness in all that is apparently unconscious. Like even matter. Matter behaves as if consciously. I mean atoms, everything. So there is that consciousness which is inside it. So I was very interesting account of Heisenberg. Must have heard Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So he had come to India and he was wondering that, you know, because all his calculations in physics, he's a Nobel laureate, many of us may have heard the name. He was wondering that how is it that, you know, my calculations are leading me to a conclusion which is other than what, you know, Einstein would say, other than what Newton would say, not Einstein, Einstein comes later. That's a different story. So he says, other than what Newton would say, how is it? Because he was exploring the quantum world. So then he met one of the yogis. He went to different places who told him, look here, basically in India, it is taken the other way around. And he explained to him about the Ashwath tree. He said, consciousness is fundamental and not matter. If you take matter as fundamental, you will not be able to understand it. Consciousness is fundamental. Now, this was like an eye-opener to him and he went back and then he worked. Of course, he didn't use the word consciousness, but everything that he said, if you look into it, short of using the word, it's there. It's almost like the electrons are making a conscious choice, you know. That's how the whole uncertainty principle, which has been, of course, found very useful even from the practical point of view, and much of quantum physics developed along those lines. So, there is the Akshara. The immutable in the mutable. So then he talks about this relation between the two. But then the problem here, on page 437, the last passage, the difficulty which baffles our intelligence is that these two seem to be irreconcilable opposites with no real nexus between them. So Shara acts, or at least motives action, separately in the Akshara. The Akshara stands apart, self-centered, separate in its inactivity from the Shara. Even if we say that, well, it informs or it in some way, something of it supports this mutable movement. But then the logical conclusion will be, why not just move on from this into that abode, which is called as permanent. But the permanent abode is not the highest. That's what the Gita will. The Gita uses a word for Purushottama, Paramam Dhamam. The highest, the supreme abode. So ordinarily, it's like, why you want to experience all this? Why not go to the source and be one with that? And done with all this. So this is okay. This is like a scaffolding, stepping ladder. But that's where you have to reach. So again, what is the connection? Why all this drama? And so here, he comes to page 438, somewhere in the middle. But at the same time, it affirms with a strong insistence that the Akshara is the one self of all these many souls, and it is therefore evident that these two spirits are a dual status of one eternal and universal existence. That is a very ancient doctrine. It is the whole basis of the largest vision of the Upanishads. So it is about the Isha Upanishad which speaks of, it's like when I sit quietly, I experience an urge to write a poem, and when I write the poem, it's the same. You can't make a trenchant division that, well, the poem and the poet is different than the person who actually ended up feeling the urge to write. That would be absurd. So the Isha Upanishad at least speaks of that these two must be brought together. So there are several verses where it speaks of sambhuti, asambhuti. It speaks of vidya and avidya. Vidyancha, vidyancha, yast, dvedo, bhyam, saha. One must simultaneously know. That means you should dwell in the Akshara, but act in the world in the Shara, being one in the Akshara. This much the Isha Upanishad speaks of. And that's where the Gita leads us. It too insists, like the Gita, that man must know, few lines below, that man must know and must embrace both and learn of the Supreme in his entirety. Samagram Mam, as the Gita puts it, in order to enjoy immortality and live in the eternal. is a very interesting incidence of mother. She says that once someone told her about a mystic. I'm not going to name the mystic, a very well-known, very powerful spiritual figure. Means 100 years back, 150 years back. So she says that mystic, there is an account. She says, I don't know whether the account is actually true or not, but it was recounted in his name. That there was this mystic, famous mystic sitting, and next to him there was another monk who had just, you know, joined the order. And that monk suddenly exclaimed, oh, the beauty of the, you know, this dawn, it's so beautiful. And the mystic told him, if you get so much involved in appreciating the dawn, you won't be able to realize the higher truth. And basically it was like, shut your eyes to the world. And the mother then comments that this attitude seemed to me always a poverty. Because it's the same one whose beauty is in the dawn. So you can, you know, appreciate the beauty of the dawn. That's what we see in that poem, who? In the blue of the sky, in the green of the forest, whose is the hand that has painted the glow? When the winds were asleep in the womb of the ether. Now, when winds were asleep, all this also comes in this chapter. Now, basically it means there that we can find the divine through everything. That's a more complete picture. He's not just not world. He has also become the world. Therefore, technically, technically is the word, through a river, through a stone, through a tree, you can find the divine. So, later on, there was a division which was created in the mind of man, because, you know, people who were worshipping the forms, they were regarded as pagans. But yes, you can worship the forms to get temporary benefits. That's not what Gita is saying. But at the same time, you can understand that he who dwells in every form is the divine presence. Not only dwells as an inactive presence, but it is because of his presence that the forms come alive. So when we understand this, the whole, it becomes samagram mam. In everything we experience Vasudevam Sarvamiti. Then comes, then he takes up this thought, that, you know, again and again, because page 439, that, well, this difficulty has continued to persist. Like Isha Upanishad speaks of this, and there are many people who even, I mean, the famous people who have given commentaries on the Upanishads, some of them have entirely, you know, discarded Isha Upanishad as an authentic Upanishad. Simply because this Upanishad challenges the traditional understanding of yoga, that this material world and the other, there is some connection. So, you know, it's so, there is, for example, they quote the verse of the Kena Upanishad, and it goes like, you know, yan manasana manute yena hur manomatang tadeva brahman tam viddi nedam yadi damu pasate. That you must worship that and not this that men seek hereafter. So Sri Aurobindo is quoting that we are told, page 439, fourth line from above, the eternal is other than the mobile, subjective and objective experience. There is a greater consciousness. Naidam yadi damu pasate. So that's the Kena Upanishad. And yet at the same time, all this is the eternal. All this is the perennial self-seeing of the self. Sarvam khaluvidam brahman. So this was the verse which Sri Aurobindo himself used for meditation in the jail. Sarvam khaluvidam brahman. That all this is the brahman. This is how these two can be true. One is that this is not Brahman. Brahman is that. The other says that all this is the Brahman. So how these two can be true equally? So these are the two and a third poise of which he will say of the one supreme. So he says that if we follow this line, that the two are different, then we will end up with last line on this passage. That is the familiar cutting of the knot of the riddle, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya. That ultimately all this is an illusion. Of course, there are different variations of this theory, that, well, it's an illusion, but practical purposes you have to navigate in it. So if you have an eye problem, go to an ophthalmologist, you can't say it's an illusion. But when you're out of it, you can see that it's an illusion. So this is, but obviously it's an incomplete answer. So, now we have the passage. The Gita does not take refuge in this explanation. which has enormous difficulties of its own, besides its failure to account for the illusion. For it only says that it is all a mysterious and incomprehensible Maya. And then we might just as well say that it is all a mysterious and incomprehensible double reality. Spirit concealing itself from spirit. Because if all this is an illusion, and this comes in Savitri very forcefully in Book 6, Canto 1, then next step is, well, even the experience of the divine is an illusion. Where is the beginning and end of illusion? Now, this is how some people, of course, they do try to explain. So he says this is a extreme statement, and the Gita does not resort to that. Because the moment I say that this is, I am experiencing as an illusion, then the I itself, which is the percipient consciousness, may be an illusion. So you see, it creates several serious metaphysical problems. And of course, the meaning of the world we cannot know. Why there is love, why there is spirit, sense of joy, harmony, seeking for harmony, all this collapses. So he says the Gita speaks of Maya, but only as a bewildering partial consciousness which loses hold of the complete reality. So there are two kinds of Maya. One is where we get completely bewildered. So I may get completely lost in appreciating things that to the extent that I am identified with it. But equally I can identify, oh, what a beauty. Where I am stepping back and I am through that thing, I am entering into the soul of beauty. So that's where the difference lies. So there is the avidyamay maya and the vidyamay maya. What Sri Aurobindo is bringing forward is the most ancient formula of truth, if you want to put it. So he says, page 440, when we transcend this maya, the world does not disappear. It only changes its whole heart of meaning. So that's where the sense comes. So we are no more living in that ego sense that somebody appreciates, oh, I am so good. Equally, oh, you are so good. And, you know, mutual appreciation club which starts. So it's not about that. All goodness is the greatness of the divine. So that the light of the sun, the light of the moon, these are the images he will say, the light of human intelligence. So all this is the manifestation of the one divine. So it doesn't mean that the manifestation has to be cut off, but we have to see it all as the developing manifestation of the one consciousness. So when we transcend this Maya, so in the spiritual vision, we find not that all this does not really exist, but rather that all is, but with a sense quite other than its present mistaken significance, all is self and soul and nature of the Godhead. All is Vasudeva. The world for the Gita is real, a creation of the Lord, a power of the eternal, a manifestation from the Parabrahman, and even this lower nature of the triple Maya is a derivation from the supreme divine nature. So this is where, and therefore, the way is on the same passage, last four lines of this passage. Therefore, it is by putting on a likeness of the divine nature in its completeness that the unity of this double experience becomes entirely possible. So this logic is that divine is also in the world, operating in the world. He is not running away. He is not saying, oh my God, this I have nothing to do with it. He is everywhere. Without that one source, nothing could be. So we too, being his eternal portions, can be even as the divine in this world. But for that, we have to put on the vidyamay maya, the nature of the divine, and not this avidyamay maya, which is the ignorant nature. This much he makes very clear. The Gita finds it in its supreme vision of the Purushottama, for that is the type according to its the doctrine of the complete and the highest experience. It is the knowledge of the whole knowers, Krishna Vidha. So there are those who do not know the whole truth. That means those who know the world as unreal or illusion or whatever, and the Brahman as real. That's not the whole truth. So Gita says the whole truth is that both are established in the still higher reality, the highest truth of the Purushottama. So, last three lines on this page. The Purushottam is at the same time greater than the Akshara. So, he is greater than the Shara and the Akshara, and both are from him, in him, because he is more than this immutability. And he is not limited even by the highest eternal status of his being, Paramdham. Now this is practical implications. In Savitri there is a very powerful line, one of my favorites. What is freedom which cannot feel itself free even in bonds? So now this opens the door to a very deep, because that's what death questions Savitri. You are into this human love and bondage and you say that, you know, you are somebody who has come from the divine. She says that highest freedom is the freedom of the divine. Even in bonds he is free. And that's the example which the avatar comes to establish. That in every state, in every world, the divine is the divine. And he is eternally free, bound by none, nothing. Not even by the conditions which he has chosen to enter into. It's like a king who knows himself king. Supposing a king is going into the, you know, to examine, to like early ancient times, kings used to change their face and they used to go and see how the praja is doing. So as the story goes, once somebody thought that he's just another fellow, and he was trying to say, you know, what do you feel about a king? And they got very angry and they caught him. Now, is the king worried? No. Why the king is not worried? He knows he is king. See, that is the difference. People who try to prove themselves, it's practical implication in everyday life. Those who try to prove themselves, they don't know themselves. Because that's why they try to prove by power, by knowledge, by debates, I am someone, the divine doesn't need to prove anything to anyone. Because he knows himself. And he knows himself not only in himself, in the heart of every seeker. So seekers don't have to try to prove themselves to the divine because the divine knows them. So always this trying to, take out, flash your, whatever it called, what is it called? Your card, visiting card, is basically the sign that you don't know who you are. So you're trying to impress through this. How does it matter? The highest truth is when you realize that, then you can walk even in beggar's robe, there walks the one. So this is the, because that's the Purushottama consciousness. Even in bonds he is free. He doesn't need to prove anything to anyone. So that's the highest state to which we can arrive. Okay. So when we know this, then we are truly free. Well, last three lines on page 441. He is both Akshara and Shara. And yet he is other because he is more and greater than either of these opposites. So they appear as opposites in the human consciousness. The world and Brahman. But the divine is divine. The Purushottama. Whether he is moving in the world or whether he is in his immutable status, he is still the divine because he knows himself. That's the beauty. And we too can be and must be even as he. This is the take home point. Uttama Purusha. So this Uttama Purusha is the Purushottama. Next page. But other than these two is that highest spirit called the Supreme Self, who enters the three worlds and abears them, the imperishable Lord. So, page we are on. Now comes the description of the Ashwath tree. So page 443. So after this, Sri Krishna describes the manifestation. So because he has to now find the link, now we have understood, so how this manifestation, this material world and all the other worlds, because material world is what we know, but there are several worlds of, let's say, the vital worlds where feelings, joy, energy of life, worlds of mind, where do all this come from? So page 443. First, there comes a description of cosmic existence in the Vedantic image of the Ashwath tree. See, nowadays they use this word, na, tree of life. So you'll see sometimes, I went to a hotel now in India and they had the tree of life. I said, well, how about making the Ashwath tree? Because this tree doesn't tell us where life comes from. Ashwath tree tells us that the soul of life, the soul of mind, the soul of matter is the divine. It's a more complete truth. And that's the people tree, the sacred fig tree. So I would often say that those who want to make a tree of life, you can put a sacred fig tree because it's more complete in terms of image. Nothing against the tree of life if you want to put it. Because the tree of life has different connotation. It had two kinds of fruits which you eat. But the Ashwat tree is a revealing a complete truth. So there is no division. The tree of cosmic existence has no beginning and no end. Naanto nashadi, in space or in time, for it is eternal and imperishable, avyaya. The real form of it cannot be perceived by us in this material world of man's embodiment, nor has it any apparent lasting foundation here. It is an infinite movement and its foundation is above the supreme of the infinite. So it's very fascinating that the whole manifestation itself is also endless. It is boundless and endless. It's boundless in space, and this is what we are confirming. So the paradoxical question is, when did time begin? So when time began, there was no time to record. So when will space end? This is something very recently, a few months back, the physicists have discovered. They thought that space, everything began some, how many, 15 or 20 billion years back, the Big Bang. Now when the Hubble is recording something beyond it, they say, oh my God, there are other configurations beyond it. So they have to change the entire timeline. We have already spoken about it. So when did the play begin? You cannot say that. It is like a thing which is going on all the time perpetually. It's literally mind-boggling, you know. That's it. But it widens the mind endlessly. So this idea that things are ending, we begin to cry. No, everything is constantly beginning, moving, manifesting. There is a spirit in action which is taking things towards, as Sri Aurobindo would tell us, higher and higher. So that's a great, wonderful relief. Okay. So its source is above, beyond time in the eternal. Therefore it is timeless and spaceless because it's getting fed from there. So even in pralaya, it goes back into the heart of the one. It's not like it's all over. It will go in its seed state and come back again. So it's a perpetual process. Bhagavad Puran describes it beautifully. We'll probably talk about it later. And it is in this sense that Sri Krishna speaks of the Vedas, page 443, last few lines. For the knowledge the Veda gives us is a knowledge of the gods, of the principles and powers of the cosmos. And its fruits are the fruits of a sacrifice which is offered with desire, fruits of enjoyment and lordship in the nature of the three worlds, in earth and heaven, and the world between earth and heaven. That's the mid-world, which is the vital worlds. The branches of this cosmic tree extend both below and above, below in the material, above in the supraphysical planes. They grow by the gunas of nature, for the triple guna is all the object of the Vedas. Tragunya Vishya Veda. So now this is where, when people say, why did mother say that, you know, you don't need to worship the God? They took, many people, you know, find it very... So when you have to tell them, this is what Krishna also says, this is what all the mystics have said. Because gods are still subject to the gunas. They can grant us things within the realm of the gunas. Nothing wrong it. We can go and, I mean, it's not like a taboo. But we must know that is not the highest truth. The highest truth is still beyond the gunas. And it is still beyond the immutable. So that's all that the mother says, those who want to continue the worship of the gods can continue to do so. But they must know this has nothing to do with the supramental yoga. That's all she's saying. Because the supramental is going, bringing that highest truth into the material world. So there is the things that the gods can provide us. But, and it is there in all mystic lore. Read Kabir, Guru Nanak, all of them will say. The gods can give us certain things like strength. Even we can, some beautiful things, powerful things for action in the world. But they don't grant us moksha. You have to go beyond. So this is where, you know. So he describes the Ashwat tree. And then he says that, well, if such is the cosmic existence and the Vedas, it is moving through attachment, desire. Once again, the question may arise in the mind of the seeker. Therefore, page 445, he says,
Page 444, in fact, last three lines. Where is the room here, or at least where is the call, the necessity for the command to action? Because then, again, the logician will say, then cut off the roots of the tree. Cut off, come out of the tree. Go back to its roots. There is no need to enter into this because there is attachment, desire and all the three gunas. But Gita has told us to go beyond the gunas. So this is the other objection he is taking up. So if this be so, then sannyas is the logical thing. So where is the call, the necessity for the command to action, and what has all this to do with the maintenance of the cosmic existence? Lok sangraha, the slaughter of Kurukshetra, the ways of the spirit in time, the vision of the million-bodied Lord and his high-voiced bidding, arise, slay the foe, enjoy a wealthy kingdom. He says, again, Sri Krishna is contradicting himself. He is speaking of the cosmic tree. And he is saying that it is extending into desire attachment. Why enter into it? By detachment, you come out into the immutable, which is also there in the Gita. But here comes the higher truth. So, that he is saying, this spirit too, this Shara, this enjoyer of our mutable existence is the Purushottama. It is he in his eternal multiplicity, that is the Gita's answer. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the Jiva in a world of Jivas. So my logical answer to this riddle was, when I was growing up and always felt, no, we must work in the world. So I said, well, if divine is here in the world and working in the world, who am I to withdraw from it? I can also work here. So that was the logic, at least to a child's mind, that's the logic I gave. If he is not here, then I understand that, well, go away. But if he is here and he is taking even a human body, taking pains to take a human body to carry, then I would rather be with him and do this work. And that felt to me is the greatest culmination of love, because to love the divine only to get his company elsewhere and leave him to do the dirty work which is going on here is so selfish. If imagine you are going on the road and you see the divine, I mean, there's the story, you know, of Dhuman Bhai. He saw mother with the cloths is cleaning, some crow had done droppings on the balcony thing. So mother was cleaning with a, so Dhuman Bhai rushed, mother, I would do it. This is my child, this is nothing. What I have to clean in human consciousness is far, far more. So basically, if you see the divine doing this, so wouldn't you say that naturally, oh, I must do this also. Why should I want to escape from that? So that's where the Purushottama comes in. This spirit to this Shara, the enjoyer of our mutable existence, is the Purushottama. It is he in his eternal multiplicity, that is the God, that is the Gita's answer. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the Jiva in a world of Jivas. So Jiva word is used in two sense. It is used in a general sense for all living creatures, Jiva. And it is used in a specific sense in human being as the human soul. So there some people like to use the word Jiva or Jivatma, just to make it more explicit. So in every living creature, he is the soul of life. In material existence, he is the soul of matter. In mind, he is the soul of the mind. And in the human being, he is seated as the eternal portion, as the Jivatma. So that completes the picture and all the dots are filled in. So and they are beautiful words through which he has, he describes us. Page 445. In the middle, and when this soul rises above all ignorant limitation, then it puts on its divine nature, of which its humanity is only a temporary veil, a thing of partial and incomplete significance. The individual spirit exists and ever existed beyond in the eternal, for it is itself everlasting Sanatana. It is evidently this idea of the eternal individual which leads the Gita to avoid any expression at all suggestive of a complete dissolution, laya, and to speak rather of the highest state of the soul as a dwelling in the Purushottama. So basically, because we are Mamaya Vansha Sanatanam, so we have to dwell in the divine and be as the divine, put on the divine nature, getting rid of this lower nature of the three gunas And that's how we should be in the world. And we see how this is laying the foundations for the life divine. Page 446. This eternal individual is not other than or in any way really separate from the divine Purusha. Why do we think we are separate? So when you realize the soul, it knows that I am always a portion of the mother. And the beauty is then you are actually free in everything. Because you know you are always with the mother. The mother is with you, whether in life, in death, in afterlife, in every which way, because the two are always linked together. Then all fear passes away. Page 446, somewhere in the middle. But the identity of the Lord and the soul in mutable nature is hidden from us by outward appearance and lost in the crowding, mobile deceptions of the nature. So that's where we don't realize this truth because we are living in the ego and we are caught up with desire. So the reason why detachment is so that we can discover our own true identity in the Divine Mother. So we should not be bewildered by appearances. So that's where he is revealing to us. And those who allow themselves to be governed by the figures of nature, the figure of humanity or any other form will never see it, but will ignore and despise the divine lost in the human body. So we can be in the play in ignorance, ignorantly believing I am just a little human body which is taking birth and dies. And then there I am bound to the play of ignorant nature. But I can continue to be in this play, but now with the full knowledge that I am a portion of the divine. This is the difference because it gives a new meaning and a new way to act in the world. If I, that idea that no, I have to withdraw from this, now, those who say this, strangely, they don't really, they are, there's a question mark, except for Ramanuja's Visishtadvaita, they have a question mark about whether the individual soul actually is true or not. Now, that's, I'm not entering into it, because if it is ego and the Supreme Self, then who really gets free? The ego is anyway going to get lost. So the idea of the individual as also portion of the eternal has been of course brought forth by the great Ramanujam and the Visishtadvaita and there in the Gita, and of course Sri Aurobindo takes that still further. So we have to not despise the world or run away from it, but instead of an ignorant way of living in the world, we should live with the knowledge, but not half knowledge that there is this world and the Lord. But with the full knowledge that there is this world and the Lord is here, he is beyond and he is still beyond and he is in everything and he has become everything. So that's called the complete knowledge. So that's where we have to live with that truth. And then, a few lines below, man to know himself must be Kritatma, formed and complete in the spiritual mold, enlightened in the spiritual vision. So it's reorienting oneself. Page 447, the divine is the Godhead of Soma. So again he says, who is supplying material for this cosmic existence? It is again the divine. Who is the light of the intelligence? It is the divine. Who is providing the energy, the soma, the joy of life? It is the divine. So that's what the Gita says. The divine is the Godhead of soma, who by the rasa, the sap in the earth mother, nourishes the plants and trees that clothe her surface. Soma, of course, we know that in Veda is a Godhead of Ananda. Unfortunately, later on, you know, soma, somras became something to do with brute stuff, but original soma is the intoxication of the divine love, ananda, that soma, and that joy we see everywhere in creation. That's why one of the ways you can replenish your lost joy, even in this circle of ignorance, is go to nature. If you are living too much with human beings, human beings also carry, but it's the most difficult to come in contact. And man-made creations again. But the moment you get into nature, you can come in contact with that joy. Because this joy is everywhere. It is the sap of life. It is the soma which is nourishing earth. So the touch of earth is always vivifying, as Aldous Huxley says. So this is the divine. And then next passage. Thus the divine is manifest in a double soul of his mystery, a twofold power. He supports at once the spirit of mutable things, that is all these existences. And the immutable spirit that stands above them in his imperturbable immobility of eternal silence and calm. And it is by the force of the divine in them that the mind and heart and will of man are so powerfully drawn in different directions by these two spirits. But then the whole issue is that if we take Purushottama, then there comes the joy of worship, because this eternal individual can enjoy the company of the divine. That worship, that love for the divine, devotion for the divine. So if you take the pure, those who speak only of the Brahman as that utter reality, they sometimes look down upon devotion and love. But if you discover the individual, eternal individual in us, the psychic being, then you are that. At the same time, you enjoy the worship and devotion. Because it's a simultaneous thing. And we can look at it like this, that the child and the father, there is a great joy from the father, from point of view, the child is an extension of himself. And yet he must bring something of his own. And the joy is multiplied when the two are together playing the game. So this is where we see on page 448. He embraces and escapes them. Embraces what? Dashar and Dakshar, both. And he is free from them. For example, if you write a poem or a book or doing a work, somebody says, oh, you are a poet. No. Even if I didn't write a poem, I would still be there, hopefully. But people define and describe and thereby limit. But if I say, no, I am only a poet, and somebody forgets to say that I am a poet, I may take offense to it. What is it? He doesn't know that I am a poet. So this is the difference, that I am all this, but I am also none of this. That's the great mystery. And it's there in everybody's life. He embraces and escapes them, overcomes their opposition, and becomes all-knowing, sarvavid, a whole knower. This is the complete knowledge that the Gita wants us to know. He sees the entire sense, both of the self and of things. He restores the integral reality of the divine. Who is he now? Who knows the whole? So he doesn't create a division. He knows that there is the world. He knows there is the Brahman. He knows that there is something more. And he knows that all the three can be together harmonized in the individual soul. And therefore he is regarded as the knower of the whole. He unites the Shara and the Akshara in the Purushottama. He loves, worships, cleaves to and adores the Supreme Self of his and all existence. The one Lord of his and all energies, the close and far off eternal in and beyond the world. So that's why when people say, why in ashram there are so many activities, Auroville, so many activities, actually all this is not the truth. You have to just escape into meditation in Matri Mandir inner chamber. You have to say, no, this is a replica of creation. Its roots are above in the Divine Mother. She holds it. And this is the manifestation. So this here, in every activity, you have to realize the divine truth. You can appreciate the evenings and the mornings. You can water the plants and see them grow. At the same time, you remain inwardly forever free. So this is what the Gita teaches us, and we can see this is why this is an ashram, Auroville, so different from the traditional ashram, where you have places for meditation or worship and a food place, because you have to eat, and some of them include a little bit, health care. I have been to quite a few ashrams. But here you have all the world. What has God to do with the world? Well, because God has become the world. And yet, even though he has become the world, he is alone and infinite. And we too can be like him. Last line. Divine in the equality of his imperturbable self-existence, one in it with all objects and creatures, he brings that boundless equality, that deep oneness down into his mind and heart and life and body. And founds on it an indivisible integrality, the trinity of divine love, works and divine knowledge. This is the Gita's way of salvation. And last line which we can read. And is that not too, after all, the real Advaita which makes no least season in the one eternal existence? That at least is the Advaita of the Gita. So this Advaita of the Gita is beautifully described. We'll close with these lines from Savitri, which actually describe the true Advaita, which makes no transcendent division between material world, between creation and that which is beyond. And there's beautiful lines in Savitri. One who has made this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through our sorrows, our sins and our tears. So all this is, he is all the time there in all these things. And therefore he says there is a guidance which is leading us. And his knowledge overrules our nescience. When nothing we can do but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. And that's the beauty of life, beauty of creation. There is hope in everything and for everyone, because the divine has become all this, and the divine is in everyone and everything. And that's why there is hope. And that's why there is the promise of the future. Okay, we'll stop here, and we'll probably in December we are going to meet. Jai Ma.